Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth.
I truly believe that thoughts are the greatest vehicle to change.
We do not care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it can catch mice.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
You must keep your mind on the objective, not on the obstacle, is a quote from William Randolph Hearst, the American businessman, politician, and newspaper publisher, known for developing one of the largest newspaper chains and media companies. I thought this was an appropriate quote for our discussion today, as our guest heads one of Australia's largest media conglomerates that reaches over 16 million Australians every month through newspapers, magazines, books, and screens of all sizes. Our guest today is Michael Miller, Executive Chairman of News Corp Australasia, who oversees a portfolio of national, metropolitan, regional, and community brands that include The Australian, Sky News Australia, The Daily Telegraph, and Vogue Australia. News Corp Australia also has significant investments in Foxtel, Fox Sports Australia, and the REA Group, to name a few. Michael is also chairman of the Premium Content Alliance and a director of Foxtel. He was previously chief executive officer of APN News and Media. Hello and welcome to another episode of No Limitations, a show where we speak to elite world-class performing men and women and unlock the secrets and influences that have shaped their destinies and that you could apply to your own life. I am your host, Greg Robinson, managing partner of Blenheim Partners, the number one research-led executive search and board advisory firm. In an open discussion, Michael shares with us his views on an array of topics, from the evolution of journalism and building trust in society, the increasing scrutiny that comes with heightened security, to the future of news and its coexistence with big tech. At an age where competition and content are plenty, he brings to the fore the importance of diversity in creative and constructive debate, and what it means to innovate, to set the benchmark, and push the boundaries. So sit back and enjoy Pushing the Boundaries. Michael, welcome to the show.
Greg, it's good to be here.
Michael, what role did media have or play in your childhood?
Hey, I grew up loving media. I am a local media. We were a family that always had the radio on in the morning, had the papers delivered from Sydney to the home, the thump of on the lawn is on the dew, was something which I remember probably fondly as a kid, and it was a habit. And sitting around the 7 o'clock news in the evening was a ritual, and then it was the debate over and discussion over supper, which was a ritual within the family. So it was something which I think many people grew up with, and it was a key part of my upbringing. It was being in touch with what was happening in the big smoke.
Well, where was home?
Home was Muswellbrook in the Hunter Valley, a great part of the world where we had a combination of mines, but also vineyards. You know, there were horse studs, there was coal mining, and so it was a whole mix. But it wasn't a large place, and everyone knew everyone.
So how does someone come from the Hunter to have a career like you? What was the inspiration?
The pathway is, it's been, I feel like it's in some ways a long one and not always one that was obvious, and obvious to me at least.
Yep.
And that in many ways, I love the story. I always had an interest in media. I always was an avid reader, and whether that was writing or whether it was marketing, whether it was the story ultimately was probably what drew me to the industry. It was one which I fell into at uni, and I majored in comms and communications.
Yep.
And that if you follow what you enjoy, ultimately, I think you you do better at it.
Journalism, has it still got the nobility around it?
It has evolved. What is a journalist today? You know, a lot of people like to think that they're journalists and that they can self-publish. I think it does to have still have the nobility that it has had previously. Yep. I think people are very much respect those who put journalism and put their name out there, put themselves to a byline. They're identifiable. They sign up to journalists today. The good ones are the ones that sign up to a code of ethics, accountable to a press council or to an ACMA in different in different mediums. They have got had laws they need to abide by. There are standards in editing and researching, and that and more than ever before, I think those that are our real journalists, identifiable, working for brands which people respect, probably finding it tougher, but maybe even more noble.
Is there anybody in particular when you're coming through the ranks that you thought, my goodness me, that person never gives up, always comes through on the story, just had that ultimate respect?
I grew up on the Sydney Morning Herald, and that was the paper my parents chose. We got the Australian on weekends.
Yep.
I remember reading as a kid Philip Adams. There was as a marketer, as the Bryce Courtneys who could transverse into storytelling. Leo Schofields who could talk to food but talk to culture at the same time. It was the cricket writers that you'd cut the pages out and stick them in your book, and you'd sit there with the annual summer of cricket with writing down every score as well as your own personal record before the stats were available, available free to everyone. It was probably those who could ask tough questions. I think of the four corners of old, and today they still do long form journalism well. 60 Minutes, as I got older, was a place where you'd see those great dawns of the ABC that try and migrated to Nine. Hey, they're all people who I think showed that they could make a difference, and that is probably one of my North Stars, is that are we making a difference, a positive one? And sometimes making a difference is making tough calls. I started my career selling ads, and I think if you can sell an ad, then you can sell anything, and it's pretty tough out there. I worked on Countdown magazine, Hero magazine. I worked for a representation company from getting the job at the CES back in Vogue. It was finding an opportunity while I was at uni, and that gave me access, opportunities to meet editors and journalists. And I was probably attracted to, while at uni, at the business of media as well, and that particularly how different media work together. And when I first started my career, you were either an advertiser on TV or radio or not even out of home at that stage, or print. Probably what I saw and enjoyed was how did the pieces come together? How do you construct a campaign? And that's part of the story again, but it's also part of having an impact on a business. And that's where, for me, a big part of marketing was always telling the story.
What's changed in the whole focus around revenue generation in the world of media since you started out?
Well, a lot of things have changed, and they maybe haven't changed as much, maybe just how you deliver it. So traditionally, publishing has been probably 80% advertising, 20% consumer or cover price revenue. It's moving close to 50-50 now in terms of client and consumer. And so, therefore, that changes your focus.
Yeah.
When we think about consumer, it's no longer buying the papers in such big numbers. They still are a lot of numbers. In fact, in 2020, we sold more papers than in 2019. Such was the demand for trusted and local news. But I think where particularly has been the growth is Australia's propensity to pay for digital content, whether that be a news media brand at a local level or whether it be a streaming service, whether it be Kayo or Binge or Foxtel. It could be Netflix, Stan, Disney Plus, Prime. Like Australians are the third highest in the world who have a propensity to pay for content. Such is our demand, and that's why, even though we're a very small country in terms of population, all those big companies look at the spreadsheet and say, well, we should launch in Australia because they like paying for content. Additionally, coupled with that is we're the second fastest in the world after Norway for early adoption of technology, and that is how our client model has changed in terms of being more digital revenue-oriented and coupled with an audience, a large digital audience that is consuming our journalism. There's also clients that want to place their messages around that.
Can you talk us through the scale of News Corp?
Hey, News Corp today is we're a vast company. Just thinking about it in Australia, we publish 112 regional and community mastheads.
Yeah.
We have, in regional Australia, we have over 400 journalists covering just regional and community news. Our publishing business tells their stories of whether it be in The Australian or whether it be in the Manly Daily, in papers in Bundaberg and Geelong. Additionally, we're the publisher of Vogue and GQ. We publish Kitspot, Australia's biggest news brand in terms of audience is news.com.au. As a single brand, does remarkably well on an ad-funded model. So that's not subscription. At the same time, our other assets in Australia include Foxtel, which also now broadcasts KO and Binge. Sky News is part of the News Corp stable. We're a 67% shareholder in realestate.com.au, which is now the world's largest real estate group, and do a fantastic job in serving our great Australian dream and a great Australian love of home and home ownership. We are publishers of taste, and so we're the biggest food publisher in the country with an 8-to-1 margin to the number two player. When we think through travel, Escape is a powerhouse as a travel brand. So, hey, I'm only mentioning some of them, but increasingly our business is more digital. In fact, if you look at News Corp's earnings, you'll see that about only 20% of our earnings are print. And so, it's a diverse company, but has a lot of common strengths in the interacting and understanding audiences, and the power of storytelling, as particularly in the fiction space, HarperCollins is proudly part of the group as well.
So it's always striving to achieve. It's always innovating. And as the person in charge of this tremendous organisation across Australasia, what's the glue? What's the culture? I know we all read about from the outside, but can you give us a bit of a feel?
Hey, I often refer back to our core values, and that is what ultimately brings people together and cultures together. So I mentioned to make a difference. We're not here just to serve the expected. I think part of what we need to do often is to make a difference and to push thinking and to sometimes be in positions of not being always comfortable, but ultimately campaigning and holding those who make decisions to account. Now, getting it done, there's a lot of talk and there's a lot of it's not just the words on the page, but it's the impact that it has. It's the teamwork. We are very much a collegiate, company that are there for each other, but that's part of being there for communities as well. So teamwork is, and papers don't get published without great teamwork. And any, I think, media organisation that functions well, it's about creative debate. And I think our culture is really one of the newsroom, whereby there's an issue. And an editor's job is to listen to the views of many, and diversity within newsrooms is vital to have a functioning outcome to say, well, what is ultimately the best for our audience here? And how can we best tell this story in a way which engages? Being principled, there's go, no-go zones. By the issue, you need to evaluate that, but being principled, and then equally being able to push the boundaries. And so
what does that mean, push the boundaries for you guys? Yeah.
Oh, hey, we've got to be a risk-taking. You've got to be open to risk, and you don't grow if you don't want to just be there. You want to be the best. And so I think in any industry, those who are the best are the ones that aren't afraid to be the benchmark. In fact, they set the benchmark. They break new ground. And that's really about pushing boundaries, and sometimes you don't always get it right. So you've got to have a culture where it's okay to make mistakes, not big ones, but you've got to be okay to say that you learn from your mistakes.
Do I trust the news these days?
Well, trust is, depending what part of the news you're referring to. And there's many platforms which you'd question whether they're trustworthy, in which you don't know, is the name against it really the name of the person? Who are they? What's their backstory? Where do you find them? And can you trust them? And so I think that brands and trust in all categories of business is now probably as important as ever before. And it's the relationship that people have with those companies ultimately which endear them to further purchase, further will pay more for them, it is about distrust of reliability as well. And so I think it's getting tougher to launch new brands. It takes a long lot of time, a lot of money, and consistency and a great experience to do so. So in terms of media trust, with so much questionable comment and questionable fact out there and fakeness, the demand for trusted news has never been greater.
Am I getting opinion or am I getting news these days?
Well, you get both, and people will pay for both. And there's different demographic groups that, thank you very much. Give me the facts. I'll make my own point of view.
Yeah.
Or give me the facts and give me your point of view, and I'll conclude my own. But given how time-poor people are, they do gravitate to, not necessarily like-minded, but people whose views they respect, whether it be a person in the morning on the radio. They're entertained, and I like the way they talk. They think like me. And people find that in a whole range of different mediums today, and there's so many of them on different video channels, different audio channels, different print channels, whereby is it a Paul Murray? Is it a Ben Fordham? Is it Alan Jones? Is it Ray Hadley? Is it a Rita Piani? Is it a Tim Blair? Some people equally consume them because they disagree. They still respect, but I don't agree with what you say.
Are Australians paying for the opportunity to get a premium service, or am I getting sucked up with social media and following that too quickly and not questioning enough? What are you guys seeing?
Well, our results show that we've had 4 years now of a CAGR of growth in subscriptions of about 25%. And we've exceeded that in 2020. Such was the demand for local news and the growth of trust and the demand and the need for that as well. So, yes, they're paying for it, and that paying for it in record numbers. And so that we anticipate that momentum will continue.
Talk about innovation. Where are we headed in regards to into news and the media platforms you guys are going to provide?
Hey, innovation is constant. I often look at the audio space and say, well, how has Spotify done so well when they were really late to the party? Apple Music was there. But it's the aggregation. It's that user experience. It's the affinity that people have intuitively around a particular device or platform. It's the editing of a paper and the page design. It's the combination of the picture plus the headline, plus then the words. And it's the combination of all those together which really engage an audience. And I think that's what we're seeing today, is that those who do innovate and give the audience an experience that allows them to consume and understand and interpret quickly and intuitively are the ones that win.
And Michael, are the Australians known for innovating, or are we really picking up the best from offshore?
I think now, sadly, we're kind of fast followers, or we're seeing global brands launch here, which we're not getting the same level of creativity that we were known for. I think Australia globally was known as a country of a bit of Wild West of entrepreneurs that had an ambitious mandate to travel the world and take our ideas elsewhere. We've always, population-wise, been a small country. But so I think that's where I kind of worry that innovation has been squashed, that we're known now to be safe, and that if you've got great ideas, go to Silicon Valley, go to Germany, go elsewhere to see them come out. And I don't think we see enough support of innovation in our country, sadly.
So what's got to change?
It's part cultural, but I think it's partly investment too. We do need to have a culture whereby there's support from tariffs, from our universities are encouraged to and funded. I think that you think through countries like Israel, and that people go there because there are mentors. Like I remember the first time I went there that I'd seen 2 weeks prior in Sydney, a startup hub, 10 new ideas a week. It's about 200 ideas a night in Tel Aviv. But that's where you've got to go to find the funding, find the stimulus, to find the peer support. And that's what I fear, that we're not creating a culture in our own country. And so that's where ultimately there's a whole range of private enterprise, I think private individuals, government, and that part of this funding. But it's also education and ability to encourage that risk taking.
COVID-19, what were your learnings?
Hey, there's been, from an audience point of view, definitely consumers settled at home for far more so. So digital devices, we didn't have enough screens before. We've got a lot more of them now. Health and hygiene. It's interesting in Australia. Are we, do you need personal health insurance? Because, our hospitals have done pretty well.
That's right.
There's a pandemic going on. Do we need more insurance? Concerns, and we've got a culture where these good times can't last. And so I look forward to 2021, and that there is the, what will happen with JobKeeper and JobSaver? What will happen with China? What will Biden do? Will there be an election? All these uncertainties come together, and so I think we do kind of
great for news.
Well, great for plenty to write about, but there always is. We'll find a story. I think there's been shifts in behaviour around people think about infrastructure, think about investment in self. So we've seen a lot of what I'd say is not essential but necessity buying around home. Then Black Friday, Cyber Monday hit, and there was a bit of purchase for family, but not a lot of purchase investment in self. So I do worry that we're kind of fragile. I think another one, which is the mix of the shopping basket has changed under COVID, and that we definitely saw periods of time where different food tastes would come. I worry for the restaurant trade, the travel trade, that people feel more comfortable at home. And that's not a bad thing, but community's been redefined. Some families have been separated, broken down. Some have been missed, some haven't been. So, that's going to be that will flow out over time. There's some of the trends that we've seen, more in a macro sense. I think people have been more emotional too. And you've seen the response to the riots around the world.
Yeah.
The news stories now is dominated by not just America, but it's Asia, it's Middle East, it is frustrations that people have with political leaders and expressing it far more, unfortunately, violently as well. I think we feel a lot more empathy for our political leaders and business leaders. There's been premiers who have been questioned and that have been forgiven, and maybe that's fair. But equally, there's an emotional overlay which has become unpredictable. And I noticed amongst my group of friends of those who were very, very brave and would go outside and socialise, others who haven't been out for months. And I wouldn't be able to pick them. So you're seeing that unpredictable behaviour, which would probably be a hallmark of 2020, 2021.
Did the demand for news go up? Was I looking at more content as a result?
Yeah, definitely. And more time on screen. So as I mentioned, we sold more print product and newspapers in 2020 than what we sold in 2019. And that's of particularly it was the Herald Sun. Everyone in Victoria must live within 5 km of a newsagent because they were selling a lot more papers. Weekend papers particularly. We got out of there. We weren't able to see kids play sport. Sport wasn't on at all. We weren't allowed to socialise, and so there was a lot more consumption of news. We saw through Dan Andrews' daily press conference a lot more people wanting to know what exactly happened, and then go to their newspaper site to give the interpretation of whether that was a good outcome or not. So there was definitely an appetite of I want to know what's coming on now. And that definitely also helped people, reasons why people have subscribed and to mastheads.
Now, exactly right. You had to make some changes, particularly in the region. So you want to talk us through why you did that and what you think the longer term outcome will be?
Yeah. These were businesses that had already were under some economic pressure, not from a consumer and an audience end. People living in regions love their local newspaper, but the advertising dollars, which they are reliant upon, had migrated to digital platforms, and bring along real estate agents that can't operate, still not open. They're open for inspections. You're seeing restaurants and pubs and clubs, which are again mainstays of local communities, not being able to advertise, and probably not come back in some cases. Car yards, a whole range of different industries that were being impacted. We unfortunately have to make the decision that what were already stretched businesses, we haven't closed them. We've invested in digital, those pretty experienced digitally, and equally that's where the audience was migrating to, and that's what we've focused on in terms of ensuring that the stories of at a local level, and that's been a big part of our growth in 2020, was the demand of local news and what's happening in my suburb.
Can you talk us through the big discussion at the moment around Google and the price of content and who pays for what? Where do we stand on that and where will it take us?
From a perspective of someone accessing Google or Facebook, being able to access our news, which they've built huge audiences of over 15 to 20 years.
Absolutely.
And that's been able for people to republish our news, that we've spent a lot of money, proofing and testing and developing platforms for and employing people and building brands of not just the masters but the people over time. That's a huge impact that's had on us being not able to monetize that journalism. And as a result, unfortunately, we've seen a lot of journalists no longer in the industry. And so that's where I kind of feel that the mandatory code is it's a code that addresses the imbalance between the bargaining power that tech companies have and local news media companies. And that was really what the ACCC highlighted, was there was an imbalance there. And that what we've really asked for, we work with Google in a number of areas in their case, and all we're looking for them is to be paid fairly for the news that appears on their platform that no one's paying for.
Pretty fundamental, isn't it?
Well, it's not dissimilar to a broadcaster that pays a US company for their content and they broadcast in Australia. If Netflix or Stan or Foxtel took someone's film and just showed it to everyone for free and didn't pay, I think there'd be a problem. It's that's where they're monetizing that content through the audience. And they would say that not necessarily the individual is consuming that piece of content and the ad next to it, but it's ultimately a lot of what their traffic is the search of people looking for news around COVID results in every state today.
So how's it going to be resolved?
There's a process. What the federal government announced in December was legislation that proposed the tech platforms had to negotiate with media companies. The Senate undertook committee meetings with both the platforms and publishers and media companies to get feedback on that proposed legislation. And that if the legislation goes through as planned, then I'd expect that in February it'll be legislated and that the media companies and the platforms have 3 months to agree to commercial terms.
What was your thoughts regarding the election in the US and the follow-through regarding censorship and the discussion around that and the role of news and influence? Does it worry you at all? Does it concern you?
Hey, it's not an easy one. By nature, I'm a person that believes in free speech.
Yeah, exactly.
And free markets. And that's how I think our great democracies do work. And you don't always like everything you read or hear, but you need to accept that part of debate is people to be able to express themselves. At the same time, though, I'm also a believer that there shouldn't be any space for hate speech and bad behaviours, and we see a lot of that on some platforms.
Mm.
And that ultimately, it's what I may consider to be hate, someone else may not. And so that's where it becomes, I think, more challenging. I think that in some cases it's pretty blatant that when someone is threatening and trying to cause damage, that it does, in my opinion, get into the space of hate.
Yeah, agreed.
So in terms of the censorship, that makes me feel uncomfortable that platforms that really built their business on the fact that this is a forum and a marketplace for people to express themselves, but we are now going to decide what you can and can't say by the individual, that doesn't sit comfortably.
You're happy with the level of sort of the rhetoric out there and the debate that we have this day and age? Is it good follow-through debate on what's to be discussed, or does it go into personal attack? And if you look at the newspapers, look at the media, there's cheap shots everywhere, isn't there? And the politicians are just as poor as well.
Yeah, I the public ultimately, I don't think, respect that, but I think the public ultimately get it right. If you go back to, I think, multiculturalism in Australia, that there were debates around post-World War II migrants from Europe. There was debates around post-Vietnam War. There were immigrants from the Middle East. and that these all became our discussion points, the White Australia policy, sadly, as part of our history. It was all debated through the media. And I think ultimately, our public, that public debate, at the silent majority, usually get it right. And, we've got a belief in our democratic process that, as policies emerge from our politicians around what is the right structure within our society, what's the right legislation, what is the right mixture of immigration. And people don't feel always comfortable about that. And that's what comes out through these debates. But I am a believer that when it comes to the voting power, the public generally get it right. And that it's not the media that drive the outcome. It's ultimately the public who listen and have a fairly good instinct to the kind of country they want to live in. And I think we've got to be happy with the fact that we live in a pretty good country, and that's been ultimately decided upon those at the ballot box.
You happy with the level of freedom of the press in this country?
No, I'm concerned of our reputation globally.
What do you mean by that?
That there is an increasing ability for people in government, particularly, to be able to stamp items top secret. And there is a role for that. That in the, if it's national security that it will put individuals or the public in danger, then it should be top secret. But equally, top secret has on occasion been used to, this could be embarrassing. And for journalists to touch items, even to touch it, not even open it, it's now a criminal offence, whereby we've seen houses raided. It's not just houses raided, but reputations questioned, really due to protect reputations as much as security. And so I kind of feel that, they're indoctrinated into the US Bill of Rights is the right to ask those questions. And so that, what we're seeing in Australia is definitely behind most other leading Western countries, and we pride ourselves on our democracy and to be able to have those public debates. And if journalists are, can't do their job, to ask politicians tough questions, and which their readers and audiences really do want them to, then we don't have it right.
So how did we let it get so dumbed down?
Over the past 20 years, I think security around the world has changed greatly, and that laws have been rushed in to parliaments.
Yeah.
Laws that we cautioned at the time could be misused and haven't retrospectively been gone back and addressed. And once the laws are made, it's we don't see many occasions where the regulators say, maybe we got that one wrong.
Competition. We got enough of it in this country, in the world of journalism and in press?
More than ever before.
Do we?
Yeah. We're now working in a global economy and a global market whereby you can subscribe to media from anywhere around the world. And that's great that there's more choice. But we see in Australia, the New York Times has an office, and you can subscribe for the Australian edition from here, the Daily Mail, the Guardian. We are seeing the cost to entry is far lower than previously. You don't need printing plants to be able to express your opinion under a masthead.
Well, that's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Doesn't that concern you in some regard?
Well, it makes us better. And I think that's, competition, which can't be afraid of. I think looking at the UK market, where there is 14 daily newspapers, you focus on your audience and know what you do and do it really well. And so if you focus too much on your competition, I think you're looking over your shoulder rather than looking at ultimately the person who's going to end up buying and paying for the great journalism that you're going to produce.
So is the average Australian reading a lot of international news or taking news from other newspapers?
Again, that propensity to pay and the ability to pay. And Australians are a great benchmark as to how we get comparing to the rest of the world. And I think, yes, we're great travellers, and we do have a better sense of what it is like to go to America than Americans have a sense of what it's like to go to Europe or Australia. And that, so, yes, we are far more, and we've seen the TV broadcasters have multi-channels. We're seeing, again, so many streamers that have news services. You can listen to news in your local language from anywhere around the world thanks to the Spotify's, the the iHeart radios. There is plenty of options for people to access the news that they may choose, as well as getting on many platforms where individuals express what they think is news.
So what's the art of storytelling?
Deep down, it is an understanding of your audience. It's an ability to, you know, convey really much basic human needs in a way that engages people emotionally. It's relevance. It's a mixture of, you know, personality and also, you know, that people that love to be surprised. It's the unexpected. And I think one of the great strengths of storytelling is the aggregation of many different concepts that come together in a way people, you know, are, you know, excited by, you know, informed by, and that it's done succinctly. And so that's in a new sense, but equally long form. We think of the books that we've grown up with and the ones that it is, you know, I'm a believer that people's basic needs over, you know, decades and centuries probably haven't changed. We want a better life for our kids than what we grew up with, and our parents want a better life for us than they had. That we want better health, better education, better ability for experiences. We want to be able to, you know, be around friends, you know, and, you know, we want to eat well. We want to live, you know, our house wants to be secure and safe, but also comfortable. We want it fast, we want it quick, we want it economic. You know, these are, you know, not new concepts, but be able to tell those every year, every month, every day in a bigger, better, more special way is the art of storytelling. And it's really that understanding of, you know, those needs.
The role of listening now. You're coming at me in so many different ways, aren't you? I'm not just reading it anymore. I'm getting hit by things like this, by podcasts. How much has that changed in the world of bringing news to the public?
Well, I think we all are far better at multitasking, even us blokes. they'd say...
That's true.
You do, you know, when you are, you know, it's not just audio. It is, you know, you can, you know, second screen, three screen. That if you're watching a game, you're watching the stats. When you're probably possibly having a punt, as well as having a chat. Yep. And that, tell me how it all kind of, maybe we're not doing any of them well, but we are getting better at doing that. And now kids are kind of, you know, kids are kind of learning that concurrently as well. And so can you handle it all? I think there's another, you know, move in media that, you know, I think in every industry, that the aggregator. And that you see it in shopping, that you have specialty stores that then they come back to department stores, because spending half the day running to specialty stores, you don't have the time or becomes more expensive, and you just go to one place if they get it all right. And that the role of a paper often is that you've got those 64 pages and you've only got 20 minutes, but give me what I need to know, surprise me what I didn't know I knew. And give me some sport, give me some politics, give me some business, give me some entertainment, give me the water cooler conversation. And it's an aggregation and going to that. And that's why in broadcast terms, those that are able to combine all those areas of content in a way which is, you know, meeting all those needs and those human needs I mentioned prior, like the ones that aggregate those the best in an experience that is intuitive are the ones that are going to win. And that's where... Like, I would say that while we have so many choices, it's how they, you know, how you bring those together in a compendium of modern living are ultimately the ones that, again, will succeed.
So how do you? You run the show? Because it is the fight for content, right? You can get the content, but you've got to encourage me to read it, listen to it, follow it.
Hey, you can look at the same news event, you know, presented in different ways.
True.
And not that, you know, it's colouring it, but some, you know, it's the voice. It's the take on the angle. It's the headline. And these are all parts of the storytelling that come together in layers that make it entertaining or make it emotionally engaging. It's the articulation, it's tone quite often. But that's really an understanding of your audience and speaking to them at. And I think that's a big thing that happened in 2020 with COVID, is that you're speaking down the barrel of a camera, but it's to the individual. You're not broadcasting. You're speaking to 10, 20, 100 individuals who are looking at you, and you're talking to them on a personal level. And so it's that understanding of the, again, of audience, but of individuals, you know, state of mind, you know, state of heart, that where the better storytellers often come to the fore, and those who do it time and time again.
Where's the revenue going to come from in the future?
It's again, it's consumers, and increasingly so. And some won't want less ads. as part of that. They want it quicker.
Yeah, right. That makes it pretty difficult, doesn't it?
Well, like, I think I kind of think about share of marketing wallet, and advertising as a category is seeing a decrease, but marketing is seeing an increase. And so you're seeing every company now has its own website or podcast, newsletter, and they're spending money with people who are producing that. And so in many ways, it's not just individuals that are working in media now. It's like everyone in the company. And so while every company has to do that, they don't always do it well. And so part of, you know, we have agencies that we publish and help Qantas for many years on their content.
Yeah, right.
We work with David Jones. We work with Jetstar. We work with a range of Woolworths and Coles. And in terms of writing engaging stories and generating content, bringing an audience to that, that builds their brands and builds their customer base. And so that's another revenue stream. Hey, data is a gold. Yeah. And particularly with the changes on how cookies have identified users on sites and how that has meant that increasingly first-party data or authenticated, identifiable data that we have large numbers of, how we work with companies to enable them to target the right people. And so there's less wastage. I think it's contextual environments. There's another area which we have lots of. So if you're advertising a travel product, we have travel brands, and people, when they're reading travel content, are in the travel mindset to just better respond to advertising. And that's not dissimilar, just that we can better target that with the data we've now got.
Privacy is a pretty interesting topic at the moment.
Hmm.
Some of the big tech companies have been known to be listening. Where do you see that debate moving and the impact it could have for revenue generation? Like you said, you mine the data, excellent data. Is it borderline invading in my privacy, or is it there's a very solid wall?
Well, it's ultimately how you use that data. And I think you need to be – I think transparency becomes pretty important for the user to know, what is being collected, and that they can easily identify that. And that if you misuse your data, then I think that damages reputation, you get less trust. So we're very firm on that. That ultimately, you put your customer first and the person who's buying you. And that if you misuse that trust, then they'll leave you. That's ultimately, they're going to tell other people about that. So it is important. And there are some companies that maybe misuse data. I feel that our regulators need to stay ahead of that curve. And so, but I don't know that we've got a major problem where we see privacy being misused on a too regular basis. I think Australian companies are good companies ultimately, and we have a strong regulatory framework on and good risk and governance within our boards. So I don't see Australian companies as being big misusers of data to date.
It's pretty fascinating, isn't it? It all comes down to, a lot of the time, it comes down to trust, doesn't it?
Yeah, trust is the saying around, you can, it takes years to build the reputation, but the reputation is built on trust, and you can lose that trust by being an untrustworthy partner and company very quickly. So I feel that trust is something which every company needs to be, trust and safety, trust in reliability, trust in care, trust in health. These are all different themes which the trust layers get built upon. And if you do that consistently, then consistently you're going to build a stronger brand. I talked about previously the public being a bit more forgiving in the past 12 months. And I hope that people do make mistakes. And I think that's a good sign that you can make one, but maybe only one. If you're a consistent mistake maker, then I think you lose that trust. Trust really comes down to brand. You're buying a brand that you trust.
Where do you stand in regards to the politicians, the key business leaders of the world, answering some of the tough questions? Should they be answering these questions from the journalists?
Yeah, I think they should be. I think there's too often, I don't know.
Can't recall.
It. I kind of feel that we need to call them out on that as being, where you're being elected and paid to recall and to find the answer. And that I can't recall is not good enough. And that's, you know, I think we've seen a bit of that in 2020. And I think the public's patience with that sort of answer has run out.
So, where do you see the Australian sentiment at the moment? Are we upbeat? We're a bit lost. How are you seeing things?
All of the stat would say that consumer confidence is high. Mm. The economic rebound in the final quarter of the calendar 2020 was surprising. Now, whether it was our hard-earned or the government support that was the result of that uplift, we'll probably see in 2021 if the tap gets turned off.
Unemployment worry you?
It does. And
we're going to be turning that tap off in March.
Yeah, but we've had plenty of time to plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be as bad as what we all dread. We should plan for the worst, as always, and we're good at that. But I feel that there's jobs out there.
Absolutely there is.
Now, regional Australia, who's booming, they should you take JobKeeper and get and sit in the lounge, or could you earn a few more dollars and pick strawberries?
You're a leader. How complex is it to lead this day and age, particularly an organisation which is heavily involved in technology? How do you guide people? How do you choose your leaders?
Again, I believe in, you've got to have a diverse team. And, hey, the team that I've luckily got around me, and they don't mind me saying it, but they're pretty painful. Getting them on the same page is not easy, but I think groupthink is, danger. Can you all agree in 5 minutes, something's wrong, being that, that doesn't happen every day. In choosing leaders, I suppose diversity is important, diversity of thinking, diversity of views, and the willingness to have trusting debates and therefore landing on the right decision quickly. Mm. You got to have doers. I think narrative has become really important, being, again, that story that you can impart your teams and your staff and motivate them to unify around an outcome. Data's been great around being able to measure how we all are doing, and that it's not the only metric, data. There are other softer, more emotional ones as well, which are often forgotten, being the impact that you can have. But we've got to know what you've signed up for and what does success look like as well. Managing complexity, being not shy to make tough decisions, particularly around people. Ultimately, it's good people leaders. You can, you need smart members of your team, but getting the job done is about is about people, and being able to motivate and lead teams is ultimately people skills is what I look for as a important factor of your team.
You have to be in one of the most dynamic industries there are. How do you deal with pressure?
Oh, I'd say that every business is dynamic these days, and
under a lot of scrutiny.
We've always been under some scrutiny. I've been in the business for a while, and that we've had 20 years of disruption, and whereby it would be our employment businesses, our real estate businesses, our car businesses, our news businesses, and that that's where I talk about so much competition, and we've made plenty of mistakes. We've played defense. We've tried to copycat. We haven't actually gone back to what we've done really well, being focusing on the audience and engaging with them with products and services and stories that they will respond to. And so when I think about dynamic, we've seen bank deregulation occur.
Yeah.
We've seen changes in the automotive industry. There's also some of the newer players that are emerging. And some brands that don't exist as much as they previously do. And we've seen it in food, we've seen it in retail in terms of delivery and being able to fly things in from offshore within 48 hours. So I would say that there's so many industries that airlines, travel industries, and the cost of travel is probably the same as it was 20 years ago. I suppose where every business is dealing with complexity and dynamic changes, if anything, the industry I work in probably saw it earlier than others. Yeah. And so change is constant. Change you got to embrace. And in fact, we're on the mindset now that we're going to be the disruptors and the challengers, and that how we build our business is in new audience groups, paying in new ways, bundled with other product. And that's what I get excited by. And that it's the opportunity rather than the challenge.
Can I ask you a bigger question? Leadership, what happens when Mr. Murdoch decides to stand down?
Rupert Murdoch is the co-chair of News Corp, yeah. Lachlan Murdoch.
Yeah.
I think that transition is in play. And, you know, it's a smooth one. It's they, you know each other well, obviously. And they work well together, and I see that transition. So I kind of feel that's rather smooth. And that's already that's been in place now for a number of years.
Direction change much, do you think?
Hey, we're a global company, and that again, directions change as opportunities emerge, and audiences change, and markets change, and so again, change is constant. But I see that any changes are happening are strategic and not a result of any change in personnel.
Okay. I had a chat with someone yesterday and he thought it'd be interesting to ask you this question. Accusations out there that Murdoch's fairly close to Mr. Trump, whether it's right or whether it's wrong, I don't know. But is it going to affect News Corp's ability to get close to the new leadership to get the answers that you seek, do you think?
I think there's probably been more made out of that than, what it probably is. Yeah. And that, in many countries, news has different media brands that have, I think our success is reading our market and reading our audience and what their attitudes are and what their needs are. It's not necessarily that, I don't know the politicians deliver us more ratings or more audience, to be honest. It's the stories around them. And so it'll move from Trump to Biden and to whomever will follow Trump. We've seen that cycle every 4 years in America's case.
No retributions in that regard, you know?
No, I don't think that, I don't think there's been any, there's been an appetite for, not just News Corp or Fox Corp, brands have covered well.
I agree.
And that a lot, Trump's probably been, good for media. And,
absolutely.
It was America that voted him in. And ultimately, they're the ones who live with that decision.
What's your take on what we've learned watching the US election? For a debate where the world's swinging, where politics is going.
Hey, politics, where it's going, I think is, to be a politician today is very different to 10, 20 years ago. Again, it's far more complex and it's what people write about you. It's also what you can write directly to them, as Trump has shown.
Through Twitter, etc.
So you don't always need, the relationship with the media as being the only point of coverage, that has definitely changed. I think politicians are far more conscious, I think, of narrative and image and probably think through how it's communicated. And that's in many ways always been the case. You often saw a news conference at 4:30 for the 6 o'clock news. That was the news cycle.
Yeah, but I guess the last big thing that came out was fake news, wasn't it? The headline fake news.
Trump definitely pushed that when he, was his word for BS. When he didn't like something being said, he called it fake news, whether it was or not, was also questionable.
Yeah.
But that was his, line. But there's no doubt that there is, misinformation that can be more easily spread on different platforms which would purport themselves to be media.
Are we playing it smart with our relations up in Asia?
Probably early days. We've got to have a business relationship with China. Equally, we want to be good neighbours, and we want them to be, good neighbours and good business partners. And so that balance, I think, is really where it's a trade war, if you want to use that term.
Yeah.
A trade disagreement, and which I kind of feel that China's flexing on. And whether that is fair to Australia, we don't want to be in an unfair relationship. And that, to me, is the debate we are currently having. I'm a bit more optimistic that it's not the first time that neighbours have had disagreements and tried to rebalance. We've seen it in Europe in the past few years with Brexit. know, we've seen immigration topics, you know, emerge in North America.
Absolutely, yeah.
You've seen also trade disagreements occur in other parts of Asia. And so this one's evolving us. And so obviously, you know, we give it a lot of attention. But we've had a productive and constructive relationship with China, and that it's changing as relationships around the world, it's changing. Again, I'm an optimist that through smart diplomacy and sitting down around a table, you will ultimately get there. But it may take longer than what we would like.
Are we a smart nation, Michael?
Oh, I think we're a very smart nation.
Do we think far enough ahead?
Oh, our reputation globally over 2020 is that, and we don't appreciate it enough in Australia, that Australia was quick.
Absolutely.
You're smart. You're healthy.
Yeah, we're sitting here, aren't we?
You're going to prosper. While you've gone through some restrictions, it's nothing like the impact that it's had elsewhere, and which will be socially impacted in other countries for decades. That we haven't seen that sort of impact yet in Australia. So our reputation is, I think, a lot stronger, and how we capitalize upon our reputation being stronger globally is something which maybe we need to be spending more time about. I think our confidence has also been, it's probably stronger when we think globally as well, and rightly so.
But do we believe in it enough, do you think?
Oh, I don't think we do. I don't think that I think the changes in Europe post-Brexit and new trade opportunities is one. I think there's other parts of Asia other than China that we could equally be focused on. And so rather than thinking about the downside, we should be thinking about the upside and the options. And we should never be, in business, you don't want to be a key person dependent. And in trade, you don't want to be a key country dependent either. And it's probably a good reminder that there are other trading partners out there, and maybe we were too reliant on China.
What's next for you?
I'm enjoying what I'm doing. Hey, you want to be challenged? You want to feel, personally rewarded?
Yeah.
I enjoy getting up in the morning and checking out the news of the day, which it gives me an insight of what the day may be. Go back to as a kid, I was an appetite for news. And I'd miss it if it wasn't part of my daily life. There's change happening constantly within our industry, and I think that there is a change happening in our country. And to be where I am today is a huge privilege to be in a position where I have a responsibility too of being part of a key moment in our country's history. And being in a position of being able to hopefully contribute some benefit to that dialogue. So I've never been one that planned my life out or my career out. And you take the opportunities as when they come along.
But as a leader, where do you spend your time? How much are you thinking? How much time are you taking to think 10, 15 years ahead? Can you think that far? How do you, it's such a dynamic industry again, and as you say, you've got enormous responsibilities. What's the day in the life of Mr. Miller?
Oh, hey, there's two aspects of that, the day and also the 15-year part of the question. Constant balance, I think that's where a lot of people think through in terms of leaders is, do I get the balance right? And so for me, I'm a keen exerciser. I check news early. Check a bit on Sky in the evening, but if I don't have another function on, which has been good in 2020, then you kind of look at 10:30, 11, and then you at 5:30, you've done a quick check, and 6 o'clock, and do a bit of exercise, and you try to get the office by 7:30.
Yep.
Spend a bit of time with the family, get home. I try to get home in the evening to have a meal with the family. That's important. That's if all you do is work, then I don't think you got that balance, that perspective. How other people live as well. I like to read news at home. That's where people read news. They don't sit in their offices and watch TV, are they? They should be working. And generally they are. You've got to have a few pastimes. I like my rugby, go down to the local club. Connecting with friends from different stages of life as well. That gives you a good perspective and meeting their friends as well. It is a job where you do you do need to look after your partners and your clients. And so
absolutely.
They're yeah. great areas of feedback as well.
Yeah.
Hey, when I think the 10, 15-year question, leaders are responsible for thinking of horizons. And I don't put time limits on it. I think that 12-month plan, 3-year plans are what the financial markets expect.
Yeah, that's the balance, yeah.
But that's not how consumers think. That's not how the public thinks. And so I kind of like to think in terms of horizons and being able to – some horizons may push out, some may come in. But you've got to anticipate how people may start to change, how competitors may change, how technology will have an impact. And I remember the day that the iPad suddenly landed on everyone's desk. That just changed the way people then started to interact with technology. And a touchscreen, wow, we saw that in movies, but this is now a real thing. Facial IDs and how you consume data and how you interpret it. These are all the sorts of areas which I find you've got to be constantly reading and getting those insights on, but also joining the dots for. I think a good leader can join dots and, again, give teams stimulus to which and permission to also think in terms of horizons. And ultimately, as leaders, you try to bring all those, the financial as well as the behavioral as well as the people components and the cultural components, the competitive components together. And I suppose I spoke at the start around my interest early days of how does media work together.
Yeah.
It's not dissimilar to in business is how these components not just work together now and function together and produce an outcome together, but how that may change in the next 10, 15 years.
So you buoyed by where media is now and where it's going?
Well, people are consuming more media than ever. And that's, they're consuming from in some countries for more than 24 hours a day if you added up all of the triple screen time they take. So I'm really excited by the appetite that's there. The commercial side of it, there is probably an oversupply. Whether that is financially sustainable is possibly where there'll be some, as every industry that goes through a burst, see some either consolidation or redundancy or replacement come into play. But I'm buoyed by the fact that the public have an appetite for current affairs. And that is what ultimately we are in the business of, is satisfying that news demand that people have that help them live their lives better.
How do you stay ahead as an organization? Do you have the labs? Do you track every competitor? I'm not sure there's all the above, but you guys are cutting edge and always have been. What's in it that makes you guys do so well?
It's not one thing. As I say, it's part. I talked about culture before.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's around permission. You can't subscribe and read everything, but you need a team around you that has that quest to investigate. And a good journalist has that quest to dig a bit deeper, find out something, and that inquisitive mind. It's combined with the ability to then translate it and condense it and communicate it. And when you've got a great team and who've got great teams that are able to condense that and give you those sort of stimulus, then you've got that's where the magic starts to come together in terms of an ability to how would this work? I think that's really why it's important to get people back into offices, because creative debate doesn't occur, sadly, over a screen.
So what do you think about that? Should we be encouraged? A lot of leaders aren't calling them back in yet.
Well, we've been big on the fact that it's blended working. People do need time to just clear their head and have a bit of quiet time. And I think COVID's been good to enable people to do so. But I think when it comes to creative debate, it is critical that we have people in rooms being able to map out and see expression. And people understand and empathize as well in what someone else is saying. I think mentorships and development and the number of times people wander over to someone else and say, what do you think of this? They just don't Zoom up or Google Meet up and say, what do you think? You need that sort of dialogue in the office. I think culture is a big part of the success of particularly a media business, but most businesses is that alignment. That you can put on a page, you can speak to people about, but offices are places where people do congregate and they still start, that becomes that melting pot of ideas. And that is ultimately where your culture of trust, standards, teamwork, encouragement occur. I think office structures and workplaces will become a competitive point of difference probably in the next 2 years, is that they will change. They'll become shared workplaces. And those companies that get it right, I think, will get a head start. And those who don't always get it right will catch up.
As a decision maker, how many decisions do you base on intuition as opposed to analysis? Like you said, you've got a world of experience.
It's not black or black and white.
No.
Yeah,
so gut feel?
Well, I always say that on the wall of the research department of Fox Television in the US, it's, you know, our strength is, you know, we listen to our audience, bend the data,
yeah,
and we use our golden gut. And it's the combination of both. And in that different times, they weight differently. Yeah, you know, I think I do subscribe to that, and sometimes you just need to base it on the fact. You know, what does the stats tell me? Because I don't have a gut on it. Other times, you know, this is something there that, you know, and there are some people that have great gut, and you do want them to be part of your business, but you need to balance that out.
And you talked about risk early, making mistakes. Part of the culture?
I think it's part of life in many ways, but it is part of the culture. And if you're going to be empathizing with the audience, you know, they make mistakes, we make mistakes. You've got to be accountable for those mistakes, but equally you learn from them. And, you know,
do we encourage it enough?
I don't think so. I was, you know, when you say this, I think about my kids. And, you know, you want them to be the best they can. You know, you need them to, you know, be able to learn from their mistakes and not do things for them. And I think the same thing applies at work, is that, you know, sometimes you don't know the answer. And you need to, it's okay not to know. And you need to people to take those risks, because, you know, every time you learn, you get better from the mistakes you make. And that I, you know, talked about creativity in our country and pushing boundaries and having that free, you know, a bit more, you know, like entrepreneurial innovation.
Yep.
And that are we, you know, too, you know, over-indexed to managing the downside rather than thinking about the upside? I think maybe we are too, you know, we haven't quite got the balance right there.
If you were to look back at that young man growing up in Hunter Valley, what advice would you give him now?
Don't wait. You know, I think I, you know, would reflect on, you know, I could have been more confident to test my arm in different times of my life. Maybe, you know, the fact that I sat back and observed and looked and, you know, it was, you know, maybe it made me who I am today, being, you know, more of an observationist. But I feel that, you know, something that, you know, can be done now, don't wait for tomorrow, would be one piece of advice. I think the confidence in having the conversation. You know, I think that, you know, you learn from people, and, you know, in business we call it networking, but I think in life, you know, it's, you know, being able to, you know, with confidence have a conversation with the, you know, a whole variety of people, and, you know, learn from them. And so, you know, start kicking that off and having the confidence to kick off that and then listen. You know, I love asking people questions and hearing their, you know, their stories and their perspectives, and I learn from everyone.
Well, on that, Michael, I've enjoyed listening to you today, and I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation and including me.
You've been listening to No Limitations.